welcome. This is episode 42 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, jovially entitled Ho Ho Ho's on First. I'm Jerry Shario, getting over the flu right now, so pardon my tone. And it's my pleasure, as always, to introduce to you the man who's responsible for all of this mayhem. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, and that's why he's got multiple restraining orders against him. It's Nick Santa Maria.
Gentleman known for his restraint. No, it's very difficult during the winter to be standing outside someone's window with your nose pressed to the glass while you're being a voyeur. It's something I do every Christmas, and you know, I enjoy visiting the same prison year after year. I see the same guys, you know, hey guys, Merry Christmas. And you know, they're all woke and they tell me not to use the word Christmas, and that's when I turn around and go home. But no, you know, that's interesting because I've been watching a few YouTube videos about certain places, one of them being London, England, where they are not allowed to say Christmas. What? It's happy holiday, it's happy gathering, it's magic winter. There's no mention of Christmas. And that's certain places here in this country as well. So in response, I just want to tell everyone, Merry Christmas. I'll say it again, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas. That's right, Jer. And Jer, you, not only are you in a production of Miracle on 34th Street, which is all about Christmas.
Yes.
You are in the town of Bethlehem.
Yes, the very little town of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And you are the star.
Oh.
And the critics are the wise men, I hope.
But, hopefully they're going to let me get down from the top of the tree one of these days.
Oh, people talk about it when you get down, boy. I don't know. It's that, you know, that dancing you do, that it's very white. So it's a white Christmas in Bethlehem, and you're the star. Okay, so I want to welcome everybody to Ho Ho Ho's on First, our episode number 42 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. We are going into 2026, and we have a lot more to do, and we're going to discuss that also, where we're going to go from here. But in the meantime, there's a couple of things I want to mention. Number one, Jerry, how are you? Other than you having the flu, which I hate, how are you doing?
Doing surprisingly well.
Good.
I, to some extent, have taken great pleasure in informing my fellow castmates that in 50-some years of being an actor, I've only ever missed two performances. Mm-hmm. And I'm really afraid that record's going to get changed this week.
Well, let me put it this way. You're due.
Yes.
I can't believe you've only missed two performances.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, when I was doing, you know, basically upper echelon theater, you know, the Mel Brooks, the producers and all mm-hmm. that stuff, I learned how to work the system. And I used to work in my days off, you know, calling in, hello, I'm not feeling very well, blah, blah, blah. And you get a nice night off, which is very, very nice. But, you know, when you're on the road, especially, you don't want to miss shows. You know, there's something much lonelier about being home, knowing that all your buddies are performing at that moment. And that's more about the road than Broadway. Broadway is more like a grunt job. You know, you punch in and you punch out, and that's all there is. But anyway, we're here to talk about Abbott and Costello, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah, and all that entails. And they are a comedy team. And there's another comedy team by the name of Wheeler and Woolsey. And I just want to make this announcement. My buddy Jim Nybauer is coming out with his 38th book. And this one is the films of Wheeler and Woolsey. And mine will be here any day now. I can't wait. Congratulations, Jim. I know you're going to stop now. You're going to retire from writing books after your 40th. And I know that's the films of Humphrey Bogart, a good one to go out on. Incredible and impressive. Also, I want to mention the Abbott and Costello monster set that is coming out. It is all of the monster movies, all Meet the Monster movies, including Meet the Killer and Hold That Ghost. Oh. They're including that one. Yeah, a great idea. But unfortunately for me, these are all in 4K, which means I would have to buy a 4K player and a 4K television. And I don't have either. So rather than buy these movies I already have on Blu-ray, I would have to spend about $600 for this monster set. And that's a little monstrous for me. So I'm not going to do that. But we are going to celebrate the Christmas holidays with Bud and Lou today. And we've got some wonderful things lined up for you. And we'll announce them as they come. Things here are going well. We just decorated our apartment here on our little island, our beach home. And the weather has gotten a little cooler. It's in the 60s right now. Ooh. And it's going up to about 73. And my God, the sun is shining. There's not a cloud in the sky. And it's just beautiful. I'm sorry about everybody going through the tough winters up north and to the west. It's just terrible. My God, this is a biggie. This is a big winter, and it's early. You know, it's happening soon, or now, I should say. Okay, so let's discuss what we're going to do. And I'd like to begin by reading some of the nice letters and questions from our listeners. They did come through, and we have a bunch of them. I can't dwell on them, but I can read them, and Jerry and I will try our best to answer them for you. So, first of all, and Jerry, I'm going to give you a heads up.
Yes.
Matthew Conium, my co-author on the annotated Abbott and Costello, sent a letter to read to all of you. And in the letter, he asks Jerry and I to pick the three Abbott and Costello movies we would watch on Christmas Day, or in the during the Christmas holidays. And he gives us his three, and he asks us for our three. And when we get to that, I'll come up with mine. But Jerry, I'm giving you a heads up on that.
If Thank you. Can you. Think
about it. Okay, sorry about that. So let's get to the first one. This is from a listener in Niagara Falls, Canada, on the Canada side. This is Jack Custer's. And I'm not going to make a joke about this being his last stand, but here we go. Hi, Nick and Jerry. I hope all is well. I hope you don't mind me emailing you. You gave out your email during the last ANC podcast looking for comments, questions for the upcoming Christmas episode. I don't have any questions, but I did want to thank you and Jerry for doing the show. Been a fan since episode one. You two do such an incredible job, and just wanted to pass along my thanks to you both for the time you put into each episode. I have your book and have been recently retired. Plan to watch the boys' films again and follow along. I also wanted to wish you, Jerry, and both your families a wonderful holiday season. Not sure if you ever get up this way, but we have this really neat waterfall here. And if you and your family ever decide to take a vacation up north, you will let me know, and my wife and I can treat you to the sights, or at least dinner. I hope you continue the podcast in whatever direction it takes you next, but thank you again from a Canadian listener you have entertained since the first episode. All the best, and pass along the same to Jerry. Jack Custer's, Niagara Falls, Canada. Isn't that beautiful?
Very nice.
Thank you, Jack. That was very sweet of you. And yes, I actually have a cousin in Toronto, and I would mix in visits to both of you once I'm up there. So that could happen. Okay. Here's another one. This is from John McGaffick. John McGaffick says, first of all, thank you for making an entertaining podcast on Bud and Lou. Like most of us, my childhood was affected by them. They were shown in Pittsburgh on Sunday mornings in the 1980s, and I tried to never miss it. I was so obsessed as an 8-year-old that I would even hold up a portable cassette recorder so I could listen to audio during the week. I did the same thing, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you too, huh? I figured out how to hook it up to the bottom of my TV so I didn't have to hold it. I do have a couple of quick questions for the show. First of all, listening to the Marx Brother Council podcast, I've heard of numerous scripts and treatments that never got beyond the initial stage tailored for them. Is there anything out there other than Fireman Save My Child that was created for Bud and Lou that never came to fruition? The last question I have is, even though the material is uneven, I'm a big fan of their radio shows. Is there a book or an online archive that gives us a number of surviving shows? Lastly, I'm excited that you've made the decision to continue the podcast beyond Abbott and Costello. I'm looking forward to hearing about more comedians from the golden age that I might have missed. Thank you for all the joy you bring, John. John, that's very kind of you.
Yeah.
Let's go to the first question. Yes, they did have, and in fact, we talk about this in the other podcasts, some of the other podcasts, and it's definitely in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, some of the things that came up that were developed for Bud and Lou and then never done. I have to apologize because of the season and my responsibilities here. I wasn't able to look up a lot of these questions, so I'm just going off the top of my head. But if you look in our book, you'll see throughout the chapters that Universal did have projects that they never got around to, including stuff like where Lou is, he plays twins in one thing, and there's other stuff. You'll see. You'll read about it. Also, the radio shows, is there a book or an online archive? If you go to internetarchive.org, I think they have the biggest collection of their radio work. I don't know of a book that lists it or lists them, but I will tell you that they had, I believe it was 7 years on NBC, starting in 1942, I believe, and then they went to ABC for the last 2 years. Their show, their radio show, was never that highly rated. It wasn't their main source of entertainment success. But, you know, a lot of the shows are entertaining, and there's a definite difference between the NBC shows and the ABC shows, which we'll get into eventually. And yeah, stay tuned, John, because we will be doing other comedians and other films as well. Okay, that was John McGaffick. Now we have one from an old buddy of mine from Los Angeles, my old tennis partner, Larry Hussar. Hussar sounds like a soldier from a foreign land. Send out the hussars. And you hear all the horses going out. Anyway, it says here, Nicholas, in the radio episode where Lou has a horse named Peanut Butter, yeah, I remember that one, there is a racetrack veterinarian played by double talk artist Cliff Nazzaro, who does a great bit with Lou about treating the horse so he can run in the race. He also does a great bit in the horse's mouth, but that was eventually cut from the show. He had a gift for making his gibberish sound as if you could almost follow it, enunciating the made-up words clearly rather than a stream of slurred, nonsensical syllables. The only other double-talk performer I can recall was Al Kelly in the 1960s, often appearing on the Mike Douglas Show, who I felt was good but not quite as adept as Nazzaro. Question. Was double talk a popular shtick in early vaudeville or burlesque? Were there other lesser-known performers who did this? And why do you think it no longer finds its way into modern shows? Thanks, your pal, Larry. Larry, that's interesting. There are certain tropes and gimmicks in Golden Age comedy. You know, one of them being like Limburger cheese, right? If you bring Limburger cheese into an old comedy, it means everybody around suffers from the smell. Alum is another one. Alum, A-L-U-M. Sour, completely sour. And all the comedians used it. They drank alum and they started talking like this. So that was another one. But double talk was another thing. It was a 1940s phenomenon, especially the first half during the war years. It was a very popular form of entertainment for civilians. People used to do double talk. It was a thing. And Cliff Nazzaro was the best of them, I have to say. I always call him a genius because I never heard such great double talk. And when I say double talk, it means they make up 90% of the words they say, but they throw in a real word every so often.
Now take your pencil and write this down.
Okay.
Dear brothers,
yes.
Please give Costello one tube of sassafras with little drops of cost and one bottle of cassisip and histamine and a jar of passive salt raised chrysilibrine and hopeless ribitin. Now, have you got that written down?
I got it all but one part.
What part did you miss?
The part that comes after Dear Druggist.
It's very interesting. And if you could ever take a look at Cliff Nazzaro, he is just amazing. He's featured in the Fred Astaire, Rita Hayworth movie from Columbia, You'll Never Get Rich, the one where Fred's in the army. So you get a good example of Cliff Nazzaro. He was also a singer and an actor. He was very good, very talented guy. But yes, that was a thing during the 1940s, especially. You mentioned Al Kelly. He mostly used to show up on the Ernie Kovacs show. Kovacs loved Al Kelly. But I think Al Kelly was not as good as Cliff Nazzaro. Cliff Nazzaro just makes me laugh like crazy. Okay, here's another one. Ooh, this is a loaded one. My friend Sam, he asks, Nick, can you include any info on how it came that Abbott and Costello's accountant didn't pay their taxes? Did they have the same accountant? Look forward to hearing your response. Thanks, Sam. Well, Sam, that is an interesting question and something I think about quite a lot. They both had the same accountant. Now, this is from Chris Costello's account of what happened, and I have no reason to mistrust her. They supposedly had the same accountant. This accountant was skimming off the top from the beginning. They had no idea. Eventually, he absconded with a lot of money. He did not file their taxes for a few years in a row. And eventually, they were brought to task for it. Here's my opinion. They were irresponsible. They were responsible for keeping an eye on that accountant. Because they didn't, they suffered. And I suppose, boy, they learned a great lesson. Because Bud, you know, ended up really not impoverished, but not with a lot of money. And Lou, he was the luckier of the two because he was working after they split up and making money. He had to sell his beautiful home in Studio City, but on Longridge Avenue. But he eventually moved the family. He owned a ranch also. So they lived there. And he died with about $350,000 in the bank. And that's well over $3 million in today's money. So he died solvent. That was that. Anyway, I do feel they were irresponsible and they should have kept an eye out. And there was no excuse for what happened. So that's my answer. I think they were irresponsible. Do you have anything to say about that, Jerry?
You've pretty much covered it. I mean, I've always been concerned about people who put such wholehearted trust in somebody else with their finances.
Yeah.
And it always comes down to, you know, the individual. It's your responsibility. It's your money. You need to keep a closer eye on it. But yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And boy, did they... They blew it. They just blew it. They were making $1 million a year and they blew it. I don't know. Gambling, you know, bad investments. And they were married to the same women. They didn't lose their money like Stan Laurel did, you know, paying alimony to 100 different women. So, no, this was a tragedy as far as I'm concerned. Okay, here's one from my buddy Ron Stone. Hello, boys. Never truly analyzed this before, but did the movies, TV, and radio shows suffer greatly when the legendary John Grant was not on board with the projects that didn't include his participation? Have a great holiday season, Ron Stone. Ron, you too. You and your family have a great holiday season. Merry Christmas! I'm sorry, that gives me pleasure. Yes, okay. Now, Jerry and I have discussed this on the podcast because there are some movies he was definitely a part of and some movies he was not a part of. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that I go both ways. I feel that he definitely was a boost to their movies. But there came a time when the movies became more situational. They became a little bit more realistic. They weren't, you know, we're going to do a bit and then we're going to have the Andrews sisters and then we're going to do a dance and that, you know, they were doing stories, actual stories. And there were a few things when John Grant was fired by Lou for not signing his USA pledge or whatever it was. And he went away for a little while and worked for Martin and Lewis and a few others. Their movies, some suffered and some didn't. You know, you had Lost in Alaska, which was a bomb and really could have used John Grant there.
Yeah.
Then, you know, there were some that John wasn't involved in and you didn't miss him. You didn't miss the routines, you know, stopping the movie to do a routine. So, no, I think it goes both ways, Ron. I think some of them suffered and some of them didn't. So anyway, I hope that's a credible answer for you. And Jerry, do you agree or?
Oh, wholeheartedly, yes.
We've discussed it.
I know, on a number of episodes. But yeah, when he's present, it's obvious, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yes.
But when he's absent, not always obvious.
Yeah. Very true. Okay. Well, that's John Grant. And here's a question from Joe Fury, one of my favorite names in the universe. Joe Fury, F-U-R-E-Y. He says, some fans say they prefer the TV show to the movies. I happen to like the movies more because of their more youthful energy, and the routines and slapstick tend to be sharper and more concise. Curious what you guys thought. Also, what do you say to people who think that Bud can sometimes be too mean to Costello? I usually say it's a product of burlesque and vaudeville, where very broad antics were much more acceptable. And like the Stooges, or even Laurel and Hardy, who are often quite violent themselves, it is meant as burlesque of absurd violence, more like cartoon violence. Curious what you guys think. Joe Fury. Okay, Joe. For me, I think he carried the burlesque relationship. Now, when I say that, Lou even talked about this in interviews, that Bud was the most aggressively violent straight man in burlesque. And comedians loved that because they immediately got the sympathy from the audience. And Bud, who had a tiny ego, didn't mind playing that villainous role in this team. And we've often mentioned in the movies how he could be cold and dismiss Costello, even when Costello's life is in the balance. he just doesn't care. Personally, I wish he were less of that. Sometimes I think he's too mean. Sometimes I think he should have thought about the fact that he was being overly aggressive. And, you know, kids used to go up to him and yell at him for being so mean. And he took it as a badge of honor because that's what he thought his job was. And it was in burlesque. I think he should have tempered it for the movies. It's a little too much, I think. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, yeah, I'm in agreement. There are certain moments in the films where I think he does carry it a bit too far. The one that always pops up in my brain is from Pardon My Sarong, when they're on board the ship and facing starvation, and he gives Lou a gun, says, you know what to do. I mean, that's really the epitome.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine Oliver Hardy? Yes. I mean, they did see, Laurel and Hardy did scenes where they commit suicide, you know, at least two or three times. But no, this is Bud. I don't know. I got to tell you about Bud. My second wife, who was a fine comedian, and we worked together in improv and all that. I really trusted her comic sensibilities. And when we got married, it turned out that every morning, Monday through Friday, this was in Florida, they showed an Abbott and Costello movie. And she had never seen one. She was not an old movie fan. So we started watching the Abbott and Costello movies, and she had two opinions. One was Lou Costello was the cutest person she ever saw. Yep. And number two, why was Bud Abbott getting equal billing? Why was he considered a part of this? He's like taking a free ride on Lou. That's what she thought. She thought, who is he? Why does he, you know, what is his purpose? And I find that very interesting. And as we were doing these podcasts, and as I was writing the book, as I was looking at the movies, you know, again and again, I'm tending to think that Bud would have been happy to stay in burlesque. You know, when it came time for them to move up and Lou was the most ambitious person in the world, I think Bud would have been perfectly happy to live out the rest of his life as a straight man in burlesque. And I also think he would have been perfectly happy never to do another routine, a new routine again. You know, he was constantly hoping they would do familiar stuff. And, you know, he's great at the routines. And people are going to hate me for this, but I'm going to say it. Other than the routines they do, I think anyone could have played Bud's part. I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel. I think people like Richard Lane, the actor, the fast-talking, you know, con man actor, or any number of talented actors could have done the stuff that Bud did with Lou that weren't burlesque routines. When people say that Bud was the greatest straight man that ever lived, I have to agree with them, but with this codicil, in those routines, he was the greatest straight man. Yeah. I don't think, you know, he was good in the movies. He was, and he's a good actor. But, you know, the bottom line is in this crazy upside down world where the Three Stooges are considered the greatest old time comedians of all time, which tells you everything you need to know about today's culture. I don't know. I just feel like everything is upside down. So many people I know think Bud is funnier than Lou. And I've discussed this before, but I just think that's ridiculous. Lou is the star of the act. He's the most versatile, the most layered. And he is the one who wanted to go beyond all the routines, just the routines. Anyway, I know I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for that. But again, Bud, great, but limited. As far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
So yeah, that's my answer to that. And let's see. Here's another one. John Hall, and not the one from Hurricane or from Universal Island movies. He says, is it true that Universal had considered doing an Abbott and Costello film, pairing them with Woody Woodpecker? No. Okay, moving on. I'm not giving that any attention, any more attention than it deserves. Okay, so where are we? I just lost my place. I should have paid my rent. Okay, here we are. This is a good question from my friend Bill Valley. In the Abbott and Costello TV series, they played out-of-work actors sharing single-room occupancy. Did any episode ever show them actually getting an acting job? I can only think of one, and it's in the second season, and it's when they play the Confederates. They play Southern characters sitting on the porch, and they're eating cake that's filled with feathers. You know, the what they did in the naughty 90s, where the pot, the, what is it?
Potholders. Yeah.
The potholders. I don't know. It's too early, Jerry. We're recording earlier than we normally do, and I'm just not awake yet. I'm so sorry. But the potholder got into the cake, and of course, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so yeah, that's the only one I can think of. They get hired to do that play. Otherwise, they're always unemployed. Okay. Our next question is from Michael Weber. And Michael Weber says, hey guys, here's a question for the podcast. What are your thoughts on the assertion that Bud and Lou were disengaged and even lazy, not learning their lines, more interested in on-set poker games, accepting poor quality scripts, generally phoning in when it came to the quality control of their movies beyond their brilliant delivery of their burlesque routines when it came to making their films? Certainly, as one of the biggest money makers at the studio, they could have demanded more quality control, but didn't. I fear they themselves contributed to their legacy of being perceived as less than is in comparison to other great film comedians. That's probably the best question yet. And I have a lot to say about it. As far as them being lazy, Groucho Marx said that about them. He thought they were very lazy, you know, depending on old routines constantly. They did request better scripts, better casts, Technicolor, and Universal just turned their backs and said, nope, we're not doing it. They had to leave the studio to actually get their first color films. Now, that's not saying that they were entirely innocent. They weren't. They were two guys used to going in and just having a good time. They, you know, would go in, they'd find out what the scene was about, and they would just go with it. It was improvisational. Now, if you think that's lazy, well, let me tell you this. I'm a comic actor. I have been for 50 years. And my favorite shows to do are shows where there's a strong foundation, but they let me ad lib and actually use my own devices. And it always works beautifully. Abbott and Costello were from the same cloth. I should say I'm from the same cloth they're from. And they were improvisational geniuses. They would come in, and I can't believe, sometimes when I'm watching the films and I know that they didn't look at the script, they just asked the director, what do you want here? It's amazing to me that they were able to do what they did under those circumstances. Not everyone could. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but they did request better quality everything, and Universal just didn't give it to them. But you have to understand that Universal did give them money, and they made a lot of it. So what are you going to do? You're going to turn your back on that kind of money? No, you're going to take your independent films and try to make them better and more to your liking. And that's what they did. So that's my answer. I think that as compared to other great film comedians, you had Stan Laurel, who was a brilliant gag man. He couldn't write a story, but he was a brilliant gag man. And he was, you know, regarded as one of the great masters of film comedy. But I think that the boys were just as good and just as effective, but with a completely different technique. That's all it was. It was a different technique. Now, you had the other end of the spectrum. You had Chaplin, who took, you know, 3 years to make a movie because he could. It was his money. He didn't have to answer to anybody. But Bud and Lou were working in a factory. They were working at the Universal factory, making one movie after another, because Universal knew they were going to make a fortune on these two guys. And, you know, if you want to blame someone, blame Universal. They, Abbott and Costello did everything they could to get better treatment at the studio. Okay, so that was for Michael Weber. And we even have more. This is crazy. I hope that people are enjoying this, because I was looking forward to hearing from you guys, you know. I hear from you on the on YouTube. Sometimes you write to me and tell me that you're enjoying stuff and everything. And that's very nice. Okay. My buddy, Angelo Mad Dog, he's from the What's the Buzz podcast, which I've done a couple of times. He's asking about Lou's health and that he didn't take care of himself and all that stuff. Lou had a rheumatic heart. He got very sick when they did their big Bond tour, war Bond tour, which lasted the entire summer. And they did like 190,000 cities in 4 days. And Lou got very sick. He almost died. And this condition continued throughout his career, throughout his life. And he would have to stop and not work for any time, anything between 3 months and a year. He would have to lay in bed and not do anything. So it was very difficult for him. What kills me, and I know I've spoken to Jerry about this, is when you watch him work, whether it's a movie or the live TV show or his, you know, their film TV show, he kills himself. He actually killed himself in front of us. He was a very sick man, and his physicality was like incredible. His falls, and, you know, when people are beating him up, when Mr. Fields is beating him up, you know, you see him, he's sweating and he's working. So Lou, yes, was very ill, but he was such an incredible trooper that he did not let it hold him back. But not just Lou, Bud was very sick. Bud had epilepsy, for crying out loud, and lived in total fear of having fits, especially in front of people. It was not looked upon as a good thing back then, or as a good thing. It was not, excuse me. It was not looked upon as a typical thing. In fact, you know, they kind of compared it or placed it with mental illness, which was very strange. So poor Bud had to live with that in the back of his mind constantly. So both boys had trouble. Okay, here's a question from Phil Hall. And this is an interesting one, and I don't have a definite answer, but I think I know this. The question is, were Abbott and Costello ever presenters at either an Academy Awards or Emmy Awards presentation? Thanks, Phil Hall. Phil, I'm going to say no. There are no pictures showing that, you know, that they were at either one of these events, whether it was as presenters or as members of the audience. Lou said in interviews that he felt like the Academy was so snobby, you know, not to even look at them, you know, or people who did low comedy. And that continues even today. So no, I don't think Abbott and Costello were a part of that world. I'm not sure if they wanted to be.
Yeah.
Maybe if there was like, you know, a burlesque award ceremony, I think they would show up to that. And you would find Lou in the audience. You just follow the cigar smoke. Those cigars. But anyway, that's my answer, Phil. I don't think they did. They were not part of the Hollywood upper echelon. Okay, here's another one. This is from my buddy Mike Alfano, who I met for lunch one day while I was traveling. Great guy. Hello, Nick and Jerry. Enjoy your podcasts. I did have a question I was curious about if you get to cover the Abbott and Costello cartoons from the 1960s. Around the same time of the cartoons, Carlton Comics did a series of Abbott and Costello comic books. Was Bud Abbott Lou Costello, were either of their estates compensated for these, and were they compensated for the comic books in the late 40s and 50s? Thanks, Mike Alfano. Mike, I believe that they were, especially in the 40s and 50s. I don't think they were compensated later during the 1960s. The images they used were owned by Hanna-Barbera. But, you know, these cartoons were interesting for one reason, and that was Bud's voice. We got to hear Bud's final work. And, you know, they should. There's this one picture of him in the studio in front of the microphone with the script in front of him, and he doesn't look real happy. But I'm sure, you know, it was a job, and it was his final job before completely retiring. So yeah, I think they got money from the earlier comic books, just as they got money for the films that they released on Castle Films. But the later ones, that was Hanna-Barbera. Okay, so that was for my buddy Mike. And let's see where we're going here. We have Charlie Crist sent me a whole thing about Coy Watson, which I discussed on the podcast last time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go through that again, but thank you anyway for that. And is that it? Oh, Nathan Brown. Dear team, I guess that's you and me, Jerry. Yeah, I think we're yoked together. I'm just joking. I have enjoyed every episode of your podcast and want to thank you dearly for every minute of entertainment and history you have brought to the world. I am writing in regards to your upcoming episode for which you have asked for ideas, comments, and questions. I would like a bit of a deeper dive into the streets of Paris. Is there a script available anywhere publicly that we can read and get a better vision of the play? Do you have access to any of the lines that were used in the performance? Is there any way to reconstruct the scenes based on photos? Also, the music. I know there are music sheets available for purchase on eBay, but has any of it been recorded for us to listen and enjoy? I just want to know more about the play in general and what the plot and script were about. I would also like to mention the moving of the Empire Theater at Times Square, where it was pulled by balloons of Abbott and Costello. This is worth a look and maybe a little discussion on your show. There are links to that, by the way, on YouTube. Again, have you ever played the Abbott and Costello board game? I have the game and have only ever played it once. And if they made a board game, how come they never made a video game? I wish there was one, but I doubt kids nowadays would know who these two are and why they have a game. Can you touch on or even do a whole episode on memories of Bud and Lou's first Abbott and Costello convention? I ripped this off of VHS and put it on my channel a while back. I actually watched it, and it's interesting. Maybe I'll include the link, but it's, you know, memories of Abbott and Costello, the Abbott and Costello convention. Just put that in your search engine on YouTube. Lastly, a personal question request. Do you mind if I wear a dress to you? No, I'm kidding. Do you have an extra copy of Africa Screams on Blu-ray? I missed that boat, and it is the only Blu-ray I need to complete my collection. I will probably think of more, but this is all I have for now. Thanks for your time, and thanks again for the podcast. Nathan Brown. All right. Well, Nathan, that's a mouthful. Yeah. My copy of Africa Screams is the DVD version. I do not have it on Blu-ray. It is one of the few that I don't have on Blu-ray. Memories of Bud and Lou, yes. People can go on and put that into the search engine. I've never even heard of an Abbott and Costello board game, although someone sent me a picture of one recently. So I know there was one, but I never saw it and I never played it. Mm-hmm. The Empire Theater, I remember when that happened. That was very exciting. Two huge balloons that you might see in the Macy's parade pulling the Empire Theater, which they moved to Times Square. And I've been there many times. It's now a movie theater. And that's apparently where Abbott and Costello did their first performing together as a team. Ooh. Yeah. Now, this is the interesting question, I feel, about the streets of Paris. You have to understand, back in those days, in the 20s, 30s, early 40s, they had things called revues. They were musical comedy revues, basically high-class vaudeville shows. And they would usually star a great comedian like Burt Lahr or Bobby Clark or, you know, Clark and McCullough, you know, people like that, the Marx Brothers. And the shows would be built around these personalities. And it gave them free rein to ad lib and play and do the things they do best. That was The Streets of Paris. It was a review. It didn't have a plot. It had vaudeville acts. It had Carmen Miranda coming out with her band to do some songs. It had Bobby Clark coming out to do sketches. Now, I can tell you this. I don't know anything about the music or music sheets or anything like that. But things were not being recorded back then. They were not recording, you know, soundtracks and things like that. I think that began just a few years later, like 43, 44, or else maybe someone can correct me. I'm not an expert on this stuff, but I'm just saying that's what I've heard. But The Streets of Paris, willy-nilly, crazy, sketches. Abbott and Costello did the drill bit. They did the lemon table bit. They did a scene with Bobby Clark that takes place in a music store. And I'm not sure if it's still on YouTube. It might be. There is a Colgate Comedy Hour hosted by Bobby Clark where he does that routine in the music shop with two other comedians. So you could see an actual scene from The Streets of Paris. So really, that's all I know about it. It was a review starring Bobby Clark, who was one of the biggest comedy stars on Broadway at the time. And I was thinking that Bud, who was in vaudeville maybe 15 years before Lou even got involved, must have known Bobby Clark from those days, because Bobby Clark, or I should say Clark and McCullough, were big burlesque stars.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that Bud was, you know, was like a hello again, you know? So that's all I know about that. And I want to thank you all for those questions and comments. And it's so nice to know that you guys are enjoying what we do. Isn't that nice, Tony?
Yeah, it's you know, this sort of an experience is always feels like a one-way street. You know, we're putting this out there and hoping that someone is listening and responding. And so it's always good to hear some feedback.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I do get it on the YouTube page. There are usually about four or five comments, you know, about the episode, which is very nice. And I appreciate that, folks. Now, I just want to read an email from my buddy, Matthew Conium, my co-writer on the annotated Abbott and Costello. If you don't have it, it's a great Christmas gift. And here we go. I'm not going to read it in a British accent. for my buddy. Here we go. Hi, neighbors. This is Matthew, Nick's co-writer, wishing my pals at the podcast and all of its listeners a very Merry Christmas. Would Christmas be Christmas without Bud and Lou? Not for me. As I've done for the last few years, I'll be setting aside some time over the holidays for an Abbott and Costello triple bill. How do I decide which films to include? It's simple. First, I pick one film from their canon for a specific reason. Last year, it was Dance with Me, Henry, because I had been so taken with its sweetness and simplicity when I was working on the book. I'm among friends here, so I can confess that until Nick and I started on the book, I had never actually seen this one. So it still feels very fresh to me. Then I pick a film completely at random. Last year, it was Hit the Ice. Perfect for Christmas. And lastly, I pick Jack and the Beanstalk because it's Christmas and duh. Oh, that's good. This year, alongside Jack, I have selected In Society. This is another one that rose very strongly in my estimation when we were writing. I'd always enjoyed it, but when I was watching them all in a block, it really stood out for me as one of their most effortlessly sustained flights of hilarity. Considering where Lou was in his life at that point, I find it all the more admirable. He had just lost his son. And the random choice generator this year has selected Buck Privates Come Home. Nice work, random generator. As well as being great fun, I really respond to this film's wistful sense of time passing, the impermanence of things, and the importance of love and loyalty. All perfect themes for Yuletide contemplation. So I'd like to ask the podcast hosts what they would choose for a seasonal triple. You can make your selection any way you choose, and you don't have to include Jack. But if you don't, you're crazy. Merry Christmas from Matthew Conium. Thank you, Matthew, for that. I appreciate that.
Yes,
I'd appreciate it even more if you do a guest spot on our show, but you can think about that. So how about that, Jer?
That was awfully nice. Awfully nice.
He's a good dude. He really is.
He is. He really is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can fully understand his duh with Jack, you know, because I've always been a fan of the British pantomime, the Christmas pantomime tradition, and have felt that it would really go over well. I think it would go over well in this country if done properly. But nobody seems to want to try.
Actually, I have to disagree.
Okay.
In Los Angeles, over the past maybe 5 to 10 years, one of the theaters, it might even have been the Pasadena Playhouse, does a Christmas pantomime every year. And my friend Barry Pearl was cast as the main comedian. And I auditioned once, but I never got past a certain point. And it's the perfect thing for me, because you could ad lib and you can play with the audience, and that's my specialty. But they are doing Christmas pantomimes in this country, but not like in England, that's for sure. But it's so funny that I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Did you have more? I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was going to continue on with my choices.
Go ahead.
Challenge. And I find it interesting. You had, you know, prepped me on this earlier in our episode here. So I had made some notes and I had included Jack and the Beanstalk in mind.
Oh boy.
Before even hearing that. And for that very reason as well, because you know, Christmas, always the family and fantasy and fun. Mm-hmm. So I've got Jack as well as Captain Kidd, because to me, that's one of their funnest fantasy-ish sort of a film. Mm-hmm. And then just rounding it out would be Time of Their Lives.
Oh, wonderful.
It's just so, first of all, such a different story for them. You know, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
But also that it has that, I don't know why, but it's got a holiday feel to me. So
I agree. It's sentimental, you know. It's loving. It's all the things the holidays are, you know. So I think that's a wonderful choice. I think it's very interesting that you chose to speak of Christmas pantomime, because that's why I choose as my first choice. And this is not the first time. I try to watch this every Christmas. Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. Mm-hmm. It's colorful. It's costume. It's got my favorite actor in it, Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
The music is fun, you know, when the lovers aren't singing.
Yeah.
But it is basically a Christmas pantomime. And I always looked at it that way. It's these guys singing and they're in costume and Bud and Lou are going nuts. So that would be my first choice for Christmas. I'm not going to do Jack and the Beanstalk this year. My second choice, we're watching today, and that would be the Abbott and Costello Christmas Show from the Colgate Comedy Hour, which I watch every year. And the other one would be a funny one that makes me laugh like crazy, and that's Pardon My Sarong. Now,
yes.
I guess the only connection to Christmas would be, would you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? That song. But other than that, it's one of my favorite Abbott and Costello movies, and I think it's one of the funniest. So, Pardon My Sarong, Captain Kidd, and the Colgate Comedy Hour Christmas Show. So, those are my choices.
Okay.
So, are we going to start watching with our friends? And why don't we do that? And I think we're going to start just like as if we were in a movie theater back in 1943. They would show a cartoon and then a short and then the film. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to start with a Hanna-Barbera production of an Abbott and Costello cartoon. And I forget the name of it, Lunar Ticks, I think it's called. Lunar Ticks, something like that. Anyway, they go to outer space. But before we start this, I just want to read one thing from my buddy, Hal Erickson. He's an author and a film historian. And he wrote a book called Television Cartoon Shows, an Illustrated Encyclopedia. He gave the cartoons a negative review, stating that Abbott and Costello episodes were difficult to tell apart. He stated that virtually every one of them features the tubby Costello being pursued by some bug-eyed monster or giant-sized garden pest, and that none of the classic verbal exchanges which brought the real Abbott and Costello to fame in the first place are evident. So there you go. They were produced between September 1967 and June 1968. That's where they were when they were broadcast. Mm-hmm. And again, it gave Bud some work when he needed it. Very badly. So Let's go with the Abbott and Costello cartoon.
Okay.
We'll have to start together on zero with Jerry's countdown. This is called Luna Tricks from 1968.
Okay, and here we go with the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Oh, it sounds like Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
Ah! I better lower the sound a little.
And it always opens up with an interior shot of Costello's mouth.
Bud Abbott as himself. And Stan Irwin as Costello. Yep. Now, I don't understand. I just don't understand how they chose this guy. He's horrible. And he was a good friend of the team. He was the head of entertainment during their last gig in Las Vegas, which Lou actually sang a song, a straight Christmas song, in that last show they did called Christmas is the Warmest Time of Year. And he sang it completely straight, and it got really great reviews in the show. So anyway, Stan Irwin was their the head of entertainment at that time. But he does a terrible Lou Costello. I'm sorry.
He does.
These Hanna-Barbera cartoons, whether they were Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy or, you know, any of those, they're just pretty lame, you know? Bad animation. Look at that. I would watch these cartoons and my mother would be screaming from upstairs, "Will you turn that down? I can't stand that voice." That was Stan Irwin. I just don't get it. And what's even more impossible about these things that I just can't understand, Michael Maltese from Warner Brothers, from Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, Chuck Jones's partner, who wrote some of the greatest cartoons ever made, including What's Opera Doc and the ones with, you know, Rabbit Season, Duck Season. Michael Maltese was in charge of these things, and they're terrible. They're just terrible. He had such a history. I mean, he worked for Leon Schlesinger, of course. He worked for Walter Lantz, Hanna-Barbera, Chuck Jones Productions. I mean, he was one of the greats. And look at what he was doing. Who came up with this stuff? Mm. It's like, let's sit down at a meeting and discuss what Abbott and Costello would never do. And let's make cartoons of them. It's crazy. It really is. But they were all the same. They were all the same. They all had these impossible monsters. You know, I guess they were trying to, you know, go along with the trope of their Meet the Monsters movies. The same company that made the Three Stooges, the new Three Stooges cartoons, was Cambria Productions. Mm-hmm. And they were originally supposed to do these cartoons. But Hanna-Barbera took over and they made them. And it was actually pitched by Eddie Sherman. He's the one that went to Hanna-Barbera and said, "Let's do Abbott and Costello." And they said yes. So Eddie actually did something good for Bud towards the end. Stan Irwin. He died in 2015, not too long ago. And he was 95 years old. Wow. And I hear he died after watching three of these cartoons in a row. I think that's what killed him. Great people on these things, though. Mel Blanc shows up in most of them. Don Messick, Hal Smith, Janet Waldo, the great Janet Waldo, who was a good friend of my old Biffle and Schuster partner, Will Ryan. He used to have dinner with her all the time. And again, there was a comic book based on these by Carlton Comics. And those ran for 22 issues from February 1968 till August 1971. Look at this monster. It's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
And where's Abbott? This is like one of their movies. Lou, you do nothing with jeans, and I'll be over here washing the car. You know? Oh, there. Finally. It's a good drawing of Bud. I think they caught Bud.
Yes.
I actually have a cell from this cartoon series. It's just Lou, but it's an actual cell from this. Yeah. Pretty cool.
Costello, where are you?
I think we should chip in and teach Bud how to clear his throat.
There you go.
Boy, Lou is more like Popeye.
Bud's
certainly. Bud, you just slap him.
Yeah.
Just slap him to death. What's the deal? Come on, Lou. Let's go. Oh,
yes,
my.
They okay. have to laugh at the end so that the rest of us know that it was supposed to be funny.
I'll tell you, you know, this is, I love Bud and I'm glad he got the work, but boy, oh boy, even he must have known these scripts were just awful. You know, I feel bad. It's too bad. It could have been a good thing, but it wasn't. Anyway, and the next thing we're going to show and discuss as we watch is one of my favorites. If you're a fan of the filmed television show, The Abbott and Costello Show, this is an episode that really resonated with me, especially when I was a child. Now, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but this one used to make me cry like a baby. And I mean, you know, I was, you know, not even 10 yet, but I felt so sorry for Lou. And this is the classic example of Bud being a total bastard, you know, in this one,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it used to make me very uncomfortable when I was a child and I just cried for Lou, you know, it was terrible. But anyway, it's built that way. I mean, now I'm older and I could see it's built that way to get the pathos for Costello and, you know, for us to worry about his birthday and him spending it alone. So let's watch that episode. It's a good one. My favorite moment is Mr. Fields' birthday gift to Lou, and you'll see that when the time comes. It's actually hilarious. Yeah. But anyway, here we go. This is the birthday party.